When Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers approved the state budget, they slipped in a provision to permit public campaign financing for elections in future years. But critics say the plan was designed to weaken minor political parties, including the Progressive Working Families Party, which has a long-running feud with Governor Cuomo. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The public campaign financing measure has a history. Last year, when the governor and legislature could not agree on specifics, they appointed a commission to work out the details. That commission, steered by allies of Governor Cuomo, in November came up with a public matching fund system. It would begin for legislative candidates in 2024 and statewide offices, including for governor, in 2026. But it also made it more difficult for third parties to gain access to the ballot. For decades, any minor party that received 50,000 votes in a statewide election year automatically qualified to be on the ballot for all elections for the next 4 years. Now parties would have to requalify every 2 years, and the requirements will be steeper, 130,000 votes or 2% of the total vote, whichever is higher. Two minor parties sued, and in March, a Supreme Court judge agreed that the changes were unconstitutional and threw them out because the legislature did not act to approve them. But in the budget, completed in the early morning hours on April 3rd, lawmakers fixed that. They voted to enact all of the commission's recommendations. Senator Andrew Lanza, a Republican, objected to the provision. He says in the midst of a pandemic and a resulting major budget deficit, it's not the time to enact a program to use taxpayer money to fund political campaigns.
People are dying. People are losing their jobs. Businesses are folding. That's what's happening right now, right this very moment in the state of New York. But that ought not be a reason for politicians to figure out a way to give themselves a little welfare, a little extra money in their campaign coffers. Pandemic be damned.
Many who did vote for the measure did so reluctantly, including State Senator Liz Krueger, a Democrat, who says she's a supporter of public financing for campaigns.
I certainly don't like the idea that we yet again are trying to take away third parties' rights to be able to run people and participate in our democracy.
The progressive-leaning Working Families Party, which along with the state's conservative party successfully sued, says it's all about a long-running feud with Cuomo. The party in 2018 initially endorsed actor Cynthia Nixon, Cuomo's 2018 Democratic gubernatorial primary rival. WFP's executive director, Soshi Nemeka, says it's about Cuomo taking advantage in a time of public distraction to settle scores.
Using his expanded emergency powers to restrict people's voter choice, to limit and weaken those who he sees as his political opponents, to erode checks and balances. And so the legislature is responding to autocratic tactics, but the governor ultimately is completely running the show.
Nemeka says New York is alone in requiring minor parties to requalify for the ballot every 2 years instead of every four, and goes against a nationwide trend toward easing ballot restrictions. She says the party is considering going back to court.
Laws on our side. We feel strongly that if we pursue legal action, we will win again in court.
The Conservative Party also criticized the measure, saying it's a power grab by Cuomo that will eliminate political opposition and dissenting speech. Cuomo and his aides have consistently denied that revenge is a motive for the stricter requirements for third parties. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastineau. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Alan, we just heard from Karen DeWitt about the budget and the fact that lawmakers slipped in the provision to permit public campaign financing for elections in future years. And you and many other critics have been upset about this because it appears to be a plan to weaken the third parties in New York.
Well, yeah, you know, look, I think everybody knows, have been espousing, you know, that Andrew Cuomo either gets a nod to be president or to be vice president. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. He is the governor of New York. He's been adopted by much of the nation as he goes on and becomes the basically alternative, let's put it that way, to Trump. He's articulate. He knows his stuff. He knows his numbers, and he does what he has to do. So then this governor, for some strange reason, and we know that Andrew can be a tough guy, does not forget. He doesn't forget Cynthia Nixon and primaries and the Working Families Party. So they're going to make it very hard for the Working Families Party to exist. That's a very bad idea. I'll tell you why. Because this country admires Andrew now. Why in the world would you show that side of yourself? It's something that I believe would take self-discipline on his part. And right now, I'm not seeing it. He put it in the budget. He has the right to do that. It has the force of a law. And he tried to do it with a commission, another one of those, you know, do I have to use the word phony commissions, which get set up to do what a governor wants because he doesn't want to take the responsibility. And they said, all right, we're going to increase the number of signatures. No, we're going to increase the number of votes you have to have in an election in order for you to get an automatic line. He makes the argument. He obviously has Speaker Hastie for whatever his reasons, and Andrew Stewart Cousins of the state Senate going along with him. The state Supreme Court comes along, a state Supreme Court comes along and says, nothing doing. You can't give this commission the responsibility of doing something ought to be done by the legislature. So now he goes back and he puts it in the state budget where it doesn't belong. Let's face it. We need this third party, an honest broker with liberal ideas. And why in the world would you just say that they can't exist? Because basically that's what's being done, or at least that's the hope of this thing. So it's a major error because Andrew Cuomo has it all right now. Why would he risk that?
And as you referenced, he's become basically America's governor as he's been doing these daily briefings. And one of the things that may surprise many of his critics and even some folks who support him is how sensitive he's been and emotional and become really kind of America's psychologist talking about how to deal with being stuck in your house.
David, he's just so smart. He's so much smarter than Trump. You know, Trump gets up there. I find it very difficult to even watch him because he humps and he fumps and he's all over the place and, you know, he doesn't have a train of thought. It just gets to be silly after a while. But then Andrew Cuomo comes on and he is rational and he is to the point and he has his facts in his head, and he knows what he's doing, and what a difference it is to anybody who has a pair of eyes. You know what's happening? It's interesting. Cuomo's numbers are quite solid, but Trump's numbers keep coming down and down and down. At one point, he was close to 50%. Now he's in the lower 40s, where he's always been, with the same crowd that has always supported him. In an election, that won't be enough. But the real question is, who will come out to vote? Will everybody do what they have to do?
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Institute for Disaster Mental Health at SUNY New Paltz has put out a psychological first aid and stress management toolkit. The strategies are to help faculty, staff, and students and others during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn with more.
Dr. Amy Nitza is director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health. She says the toolkit, which appears as a 60-page PowerPoint presentation, is also in Spanish, with other languages to come.
The first step really is to figure out specifically what it is that's causing you stress at any particular moment. So this situation can really be overwhelming and just feel like a big cloud of stress and anxiety. And so slowing down and teasing that apart and figuring out what it is specifically that's causing you the most distress at any given time, breaking it down into a list of smaller stresses instead of one big ball of stress is the first step. And then being able to tackle each of the things on the list by just, first of all, deciding, are each of these things that I do have some control over or things that I don't have control over? And so there are pieces of this that, unfortunately, we all just have to accept as things that are outside of our control. And then there are other pieces of this that we do have some control over, even if they aren't the choices that we would normally choose to make. The things that we don't have control over, we can still develop and make a plan for a set of coping strategies around it. So if there are pieces of this that you know you're just going to have to tolerate and get through, what can you do to regulate your emotions when those things get particularly stressful? This is where things like mindfulness or deep breathing exercises or, you know, stretching, relaxation, things like that come in to help you regulate your own emotions when you can't control what's happening on the outside.
How are you seeing this affect the New Paltz campus? I know everyone's pretty much off campus, but how are you seeing this affect?
Yeah, so we offered, Carla Vermeulen and I offered a training for the Campus Administrative Council, which is a big group of people in administrative positions. And really, this is a situation where now we are all sort of needing to be more actively focused on caring for ourselves and caring for others in a way that emotionally, I guess I should say, in a way that we aren't always directly focused on. And so, you know, from faculty members needing to maybe spend more time checking on students and making sure that they're doing okay before they launch right into the lesson, to administrators needing to check on their teams, their staff, and make sure that their staff are, or find out how their staff are coping and leading in a different way than they typically do. And so offering them tools for things like being able to listen effectively and respond effectively to other people's distress, and just being able to sit and, yeah, hear someone's story and respond effectively at the same time that we're caring for ourselves. Again, this is just such a situation where we're all needing to balance caring for ourselves with caring for everybody around us, that it makes it particularly complex.
You and I, unfortunately, tend to speak when there's been a disaster, generally of the natural disaster kind, or, you know, some sort of tragedy, aircraft or a train or something of that nature. How does this differ, this kind of tragedy differ from the others in terms of how people are reacting, the anxiety level, and then you in the field kind of administering that psychological first aid? How does it differ?
Yeah, it differs in a few ways. You know, I think the first one is that for the other kinds of disasters that you just listed, there's usually an endpoint, a clear endpoint. And so we know the situation is over, the immediate danger is over, and then we can start to recover. And even if the recovery is deeply painful and difficult and long, we know that we're safe and that process can start. One of the things that's, I think it's creating much of the anxiety around this, is that we don't know when it's over, and we don't know when or if we're safe. And so the ambiguity and the uncertainty just continues over a long period of time. And that's really hard on us as humans physiologically, to stay in that state of stress over a longer period of time. And we typically say people need to feel safe before, that's the first step in the recovery process. And so in this period where we don't know when we're officially all going to be safe again, it's hard for what we would typically call recovery to start. The scope of this psychologically is just so much bigger than most other disasters that we typically talk about.
Dr. Amy Nitze is director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at SUNY New Paltz. There's a link to the Psychological First Aid and Stress Management Toolkit at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
A new survey shows the COVID-19 pandemic has dealt consumer confidence across New York State a severe blow. More from the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas.
New York consumer sentiment has taken a direct hit in the days and weeks since coronavirus cases began popping up in the state. According to the latest poll by the Siena College Research Institute, the New York State Index of Consumer Sentiment in the first quarter of 2020 stands at 66.4, down 26.6 points from the last measurement in the fourth quarter of 2019. New York's overall index of consumer sentiment is 22.7 points below the nation's index of 89.1. Siena's Doug Lonstrom.
Upshot of all of this is everyone has gotten crushed, whether it's the nation or New York State. Okay, everything is down except in a few cases. Republicans and high income are still a little bit above average, but the rest of us are now in pessimistic territories.
Lonstrom says buying plans are down in the first quarter of 2020. as compared against the fourth quarter of 2019. For cars and trucks, to 18.8% from 21.6%, consumer electronics to 38.6% from 52.4%, furniture to 24.2% from 31%, homes at 8.1% from 11.1%, and major home improvements to 19% from 25.2%.
So last quarter, everybody was optimistic. This quarter, almost everybody is pessimistic. Doesn't matter where New York City, upstate, downstate, Democrat, young, old, male, female, low income, everybody has gotten crushed. Index numbers are down anywhere from 15 points for older New Yorkers, females, and 44 points for women in current index. Okay, so we're big spread. Everybody's down. The nation dropped 10 points. New York State dropped 27 points. We're now 23 points below the nation.
Lundstrom says the gloom could linger. Asked, how do you think businesses will do in the next 5 years? The majority responded negatively.
A couple of good highlights. Concern about gas prices is way down. Nobody's driving anymore. Okay, so it dropped from 41% being worried about gas prices hurting the budget. That's now down to 27. For older New Yorkers, that's down to 10% from 28%. So the older people clearly are staying at home. Food prices, a little bit of a drop from a concern of 58% hurting the budget to down to 55. Again, the older people are in the better category. About 40% of them still feel prices are hurting.
Lundstrom says while people are feeling bad right now, they are optimistic looking farther ahead into the future. There's more at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week, Kate Boycourt. She is the director of the Resilience at the Waterfront Alliance. Hello, Kate.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Wonderful to talk to you. Appreciate you making the time. And I first would like you to start with, what is the Resilience at the Waterfront Alliance?
So essentially, we're an organization of over 1,100 alliance partners, and that's a wide range of stakeholders from grassroots to civic to business to a broad range of folks that really care about the future of our city, of our region, of our waterfront. And we have been working with a broad coalition of folks that are fighting for resilience of our region to climate change and sea level rise. We really recognize that there's been some traction, thankfully, on greenhouse gas mitigation in the state level and in both New York and New Jersey. But there really hasn't been much of a plan for the more than 1 million people that we have in the floodplain today and rising. The more than, 1 in 10 public housing complexes that are in the floodplain, there's huge risks that we have and we are facing more of as we face climate change. And so we've been gathering together with folks that do first response, that are in the floodplain, are affected by flooding every day or by Sandy, and we're fighting for change. So that's everything from national flood insurance program reform to budgetary investments in long-term risk reduction, which I think we'll talk a little bit more about today.
Yeah, let's get into this $3 billion Restoring Mother Nature Bond Act that the legislature has. We're going to be voting in November on this Bond Act. The issue, of course, is will it ultimately survive this pandemic? And so far it has, right?
So far, I think it's a great question, though. It's a bit in the balance. I think that we need to look at what we're investing in statewide and think about both the short-term response, which is needed more than ever. We're talking about the frontline workers that are responding, the medical professionals, community responders that are overtaxed and underpaid. We have a responsibility to respond to that baseline need, first and foremost. At the same time, we need to be investing in our long-term resilience. If we're not doing that, we're just going to end up where we started. And we know that climate, as I mentioned, we've already experienced Sandy. We've already experienced everyday flooding in some neighborhoods. We need a plan for that. And so that's one thing that I think the Bond Act can be this opportunity for a win-win, where we're restoring our economy through green jobs, and also thinking about that long-term resilience. So I think it's we need both. And that's really the simple answer to the question.
Are we moving fast enough, Kate? I mean, we see a lot of projections. So we keep hearing that the projections are being blown away by the latest hot year on record and greenhouse gases rising. The issue is a $3 billion bond act in New York enough? Do we have to do even more to reach those goals so that we can start to bring down those emissions?
So it is a significant down payment. In reality, we need far more. And I think that there are existing funding sources to kind of get us to some of the greenhouse gas reduction work that needs to happen. We have a surcharge on our energy bill to make investments in efficiency, things that lead to reductions. We have no such fund, long-term fund, for dealing with flooding and impacts of climate change. And so that's something that we're looking at too. And we've seen some real traction and even support for looking at long-term funding sources, such as a surcharge on insurance, to make sure that this Bond Act isn't just something we vote on every number of years, but it's sustainable. And we think there are ways that really are progressive that can do that, that have been tested and have support. So that's something that, you know, statewide, but globally, federally, we're not doing our job. I think we should commend the state and its commitment to reductions in greenhouse gases. But again, as I said, for the 6 feet of sea level rise that we face by the end of the century, perhaps no matter what we do, we really don't have a plan for that. And so that's kind of where we're coming at this.
I know the numbers are not all in yet, but one of the things we've noticed from this pandemic, perhaps somewhat of a silver lining when it comes to emissions, is that because everyone's sheltering in place in these larger cities, states like New York and California, the cars aren't running. There aren't many cars on the road and the emissions are dropping. Is there any thought that similar things may take place in the future, let's say past a COVID pandemic, where in order to get those emissions down, we have shelter-in-place orders for the environment?
I hope not. This shouldn't be a trade-off like that. You know, we should be able to have a great and wonderful future that doesn't require us to take horrific measures like staying away from our families and sheltering in place. I think it's an interesting case study, but this is not how we want to get to greenhouse gas reductions. And I think that it's sort of a dangerous message to look at this is you know, a potential way to do so. I think there's a lot of other things that we can be doing to make sure our energy sources are clean in the first place, instead of, you know, looking at these hard sacrifices that, you know, we don't really need to make if we do the right thing.
Can New York do it? Can other states similarly do what we need to do to shore up our transit systems, our infrastructure, the coastlines, if we don't have full cooperation, Kate, from the federal government?
Yeah, I think that it's a huge challenge. I mean, we don't have federal resources like the, you know, if you don't have federal resources, the scale of funding that you have access to is quite small. And one case in point, we had a coastal risk study that the Army Corps of Engineers was undergoing in our region this past year to look at coastal risk. It had a lot of problems with it, but it was one of the few pathways to federal funding that we have for real investments in infrastructure. And that was pulled out from under us. So I think, you know, the Bond Act, as I said, is a great start. And we need it. It is the first one, I think, since 96 that we have had as an opportunity to look at everything from floodplain restoration to, you know, making our buildings more efficient. But We do need more. We need that federal support, and we need global support, honestly. And I think that we have to look to future leadership probably to get us there.
The numbers of people that I hear from at public radio that are interested in this subject is overwhelming. People are concerned about climate change, Kate. But one of the things that happens is many people feel helpless. What advice do you have for people for what they can do to help, and how might they get involved with you? Is that something they can do?
Absolutely. So in terms of personal things that we can do, there's certainly things that you can do to reduce your carbon footprint, but also find out whether or not you live where the floodplain is or close to you. You know, find out, learn about your future climate projections. We have them in New York State and New York City. And if you're in a floodplain, get flood insurance. It's something that is a cost now, but is something that is so important in terms of boosting our ability to bounce back. And in terms of getting in touch with us, absolutely. We're launching a campaign this July. So you can join us. You can go to our website, www.waterfrontalliance.org, and get involved.
We've been speaking with Kate Boycourt. She's the Director of Resilience at the Waterfront Alliance. Kate, thank you so much for joining us on the Legislative Gazette.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2015, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gastina.